Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Professor Muller, thanks for being here. You got to Berkeley in the early 60s as a physics graduate student, and you've been here ever since. What is it about Berkeley and this campus that keeps you here?
This university is one of the greatest places in the world for anyone who is part of the intellectual world. It's a place where discoveries occur on a weekly basis, if not a daily basis. It's a place where there are experts everywhere. It's an atmosphere of learning, of discovering. The campus is physically beautiful. I feel as if we are the honored guests of a society that has decided to put us together so that we can advance knowledge and teach it. And I just can't imagine a better place to spend my life.
So spreading that knowledge, one of the big things you do, obviously, on campus is you teach a physics course for non-scientists, for undergraduate students. Why is that important?
Well, there's a great joy in teaching. It's one thing to know something. If there's nobody to share it with, it's not nearly as much fun. Research also can be very stressful, very difficult. You can go for months or even years without knowing whether you're really doing something important. You walk into a classroom and you get immediate rewards. I think it's a perfect balance with teaching. When you're teaching, the students let you know right away if you're doing a good job. It's instant feedback.
To other O2s making O3. So the basic idea is UV plus O2 goes to O plus O, and then O plus another O2 goes to O3, and that's ozone. Ozone is actually a poisonous gas.
And this class in particular, Physics for Future Presidents, do you hope that those non-science students, maybe one of them will become president?
I take it very seriously. I really, when I walk into each lecture, I look at that class and I imagine that one of them will be president someday. And I'm thinking, what do I need to teach that student so the student will be a more effective president? What will I kick myself if I omitted and didn't teach? I really treat the students in this way. They can sense. They know I do. Far more likely that a student from the liberal arts, from business, law, English, or history, will become president than a physics major.
As a scientist, there's so much science in your head. How do you know what to boil down, what they do need to know?
Well, the interesting thing here is, of all the things I could be teaching, I ask, what are the things that are truly important, obviously important? And if it doesn't fit that category, I leave it out. Even so, there's always a problem. There's too much material to present. But the concept is, teach only the things that are obviously important, the things that you really would expect and hope your president would know all about.
We came and visited you one day when you were teaching that class, and it really looked to me like you were enjoying it.
Oh, it's wonderful. I mean, when you have bright students and they're paying attention and they're listening to every word you say and you know what you're saying is important and they know it's important, it's a wonderful chemistry. It's like a good conversation. It's a great experience.
Through my body down to the ground and then coming back to the apparatus, and I'm not killed.
A lot of students have had bad experiences in the sciences, in physics in particular. I exchange email with all of my students, and I ask them about their physics experiences. About half of my students either hate physics or swore they'd never take it again. And yet they take it again. And that shows a degree of courage. They also recognize how important it is. And they're there because they know it's important, and I get to teach them. I think if you dislike physics, it's not your fault. I think we teach it badly. We're frequently teaching only to the students who are going to become future physicists. We don't do that with English. We don't do that with history. We teach everybody that. We need to do that with physics, too, and that's what I'm trying to do.
And so you decided that the class wasn't enough. There needed to be a book for the general public?
Well, the class was very successful, but I had always hoped the class would expand beyond Berkeley, and it is. There are versions of this class that are being taught now at about a dozen universities around the United States, and proposals to do it in India and other places. I had to write a textbook in order for that to happen. And then I recognized that if I wanted to reach out beyond the students, if I wanted to get to some of the people who are in power already, that I had to write a more popular version, a book that would be read for pleasure, not for a grade. And so that's why I wrote the popular version of my book.
So you have the sense that the presidents aren't getting the right science education, or they don't know what they need to know to make informed decisions?
I think there have been mistakes made in the past simply because people at the high level, not just the presidents, but congressmen and legislators, have not had the background they need. They depend on a science advisor to give them information. The trouble is the science advisor will always give the information based on the scientific aspects of it. The president, if he or she doesn't understand the physics, then they don't know how to balance the diplomacy, the economics, the science, all these things. My feeling is it's not good enough to have a good science advisor. The president, in this case, our upcoming president, Barack Obama, needs to understand this stuff himself.
The first thing I thought when I looked through the book was, boy, with all the things on a president's plate, can we really expect them to learn the physics behind these problems?
Absolutely, yes. Just as we expect a president to know the difference between Shiite and Sunni, we expect a president these days to know what a credit default debts are. The president has to know the difference between a uranium bomb and a plutonium bomb. If the president doesn't understand this, it's hard to make decisions with what to do about North Korea, what's going on in Iran. The bombs that they're developing are different. They've had different experiences. If you're going to have a diplomacy, if you're going to negotiate with North Korea, it's important to recognize how they built their bomb, how well it worked, the fact that it was a fizzle, the fact that it released only 5% of the energy of our plutonium bombs, what their options are, what's going on with Iran. Do they have a legitimate reason for enriching uranium? It turns out that they do. How hard is it if they have enriched this uranium to make a bomb if they don't have a bomb program? And it turns out the answer is it's very easy for uranium. Very tough for plutonium, very easy for uranium. These are just the sorts of things that the president of the United States should know and should understand at a gut level.
And what's at stake if he doesn't get it?
Well, I'll give an example. President George Bush in 2003 started a big program for the U.S. to go towards a hydrogen economy. There are some basic elements of physics of hydrogen that I think he didn't understand at the time. Hydrogen has a lot more energy per pound than does gasoline, but it's a lot less energy, 4 times less per gallon, because a pound of hydrogen takes a lot of space. Hydrogen is not a source of energy. It's simply a way of transporting energy. We don't mine hydrogen. We have to make it. That takes energy. Right now, we get most of our hydrogen from natural gas. So it actually does contribute to the greenhouse. So there are a lot of physics facts. A year later, in his State of the Union message, President Bush made no mention whatsoever of the hydrogen economy. I think in the interim, he learned some physics. But the president needs to know the physics before he announces policy. We live in an amazingly high-tech world, and physics is the liberal arts of high technology. You understand the physics, and no high technology is beyond your understanding.
Let's talk about global warming. Tell me, what does a president need to know to make a right decision on how to fix the global warming problem?
Well, you have to recognize how bad it is. And the surprising answer is that so far it hasn't been very bad. We've had about 1 degree Fahrenheit of global warming so far, none whatsoever in the last 10 years. You need to know that because otherwise you will misunderstand when people criticize global warming. They say it's not real. The reason they're saying it's not real is there hasn't been any in 10 years. But we don't expect it to happen every year. It's a gradual thing that builds up. Some people might criticize global warming because they say it's based on elaborate computer programs. In fact, the calculations of global warming go back to 1896. And they predicted about the right levels, what we're seeing today, that with the 35% increase in carbon dioxide that we have been responsible for, you expect about 1 degree Fahrenheit of global warming, which is what we've seen. So global warming is real. We expect that in the next 30 or 40 years, that humans will double the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. When that happens, then the calculations indicate the temperature will go up 5, maybe 6 degrees Fahrenheit. So this is the basic physics. There's additional things, too. Maybe it's called engineering, I'm not sure. But the United States has contributed more than its share of the carbon dioxide, share per person, not more than its share per GDP, but share per person. But in the future, most of the carbon dioxide is going to be coming from the developing countries, from China, from India. These are the countries. China now surpasses the U.S. in total CO2. Yeah, that's less per person, but it's more CO2. And they're growing at over 10% per year in the CO2 that they're producing. So most of the global warming that will be happening in the next 20, 30, 40 years will come from the developing world. This has important implications. What it means is any technology that reduces the carbon, if we use it, that will set an example. But if they can't afford to follow our example because it's expensive technology, then it's not going to address the problem.
So our president, in understanding this, needs to decide what policies or what technologies he's going to promote.
Well, one of the key things that I hope President Obama will implement is that the one kind of energy that can be afforded by everybody is called conservation. You reduce the energy that you're using for the same gain. There's a lot that can be done on this, an enormous amount that can be done. By itself, it's not enough. We're going to need other alternative energy. Solar is coming along very rapidly, but it's not quite there yet. It's still, unfortunately, expensive. We can afford it in the U.S., and maybe if we use a lot in the U.S., the price will come down. But unless the price comes down, it's not going to be widely used in China and India. Nuclear power. Another important technology that we once dismissed because it was dangerous, now we recognize that fossil fuels are dangerous too. The Chernobyl accident frightened many people. What's the Chernobyl equivalent for fossil fuel? Well, global warming is one of them. Another is war in the Mideast. We wouldn't be fighting war in the Mideast if the Mideast didn't have all of that oil. So nuclear, the fact that it's dangerous doesn't mean that we can dismiss it. We have to compare the dangers of that to the dangers of the alternatives. Solar isn't really an alternative yet. We hope it will be, but it's not there yet. I would like to see President Obama explain to the nation himself that the nuclear waste storage problem is essentially a solved problem. I mean, he could have me do that, but I don't think the country would believe me. I think you need to have President Obama understand this and explain it and convince the public that this is one of the spectrum of things that we need to solve the global warming problem. Not the global warming we've had so far, but the global warming that we expect will happen over the next few decades.
And I noticed in your book that a lot of the one of the most important things that the president needs to consider in all of these issues, even terrorism and the others, and space exploration, have to do with the relative costs of solving it one way compared to solving it another way.
Yeah, some people think physics doesn't involve costs, but any physicist knows that to do an experiment, you have to bring the price down where it's affordable. Now, cost is central, the cost of space exploration. It costs one-tenth to do it with robots compared to humans. So there are some places where you might want to bring humans, but for the most part, if you could do 10 times as much with robots, you're much better off doing that. In energy, the cost is central. Cheap energy, we're not running out of fossil fuels. We're running out of cheap fossil fuels. All of these things, the cost is central. I think that's part of physics.
Does the president's success in any of these areas depend on his understanding of the physics behind them?
I think so. I think, like, take nuclear power, for example. Nuclear power has, the price has come down. It's less expensive. We are much less worried now than we once were about the China syndrome and the leakages. But there's still issues of nuclear waste. And you have people shouting on all sides. You have people saying nuclear waste is a solved problem, as I just did. You have people saying it's an unsolved problem, that nuclear waste lasts for 24,000 years. There's no way you can guarantee its security. The president can listen to these people, but how does he know who's right? How does he adjudicate these various things? I think the president needs to understand the issues. He has to know that when we're talking about 24,000 years, we're talking about the half-life of plutonium. The fact that the experts don't believe plutonium is that much of a problem because it's very insoluble in groundwater. And you have to drink half a gram in order to get cancer from groundwater. So the 24,000 years is a red herring. The other radioactivity goes away much faster. The president has to understand this in order to make a decision about nuclear power.
So he needs to understand enough to be able to weigh what will make how much of a difference to our lives, I guess.
Let's take an example of terrorism. What should the president be worrying about for the next terrorist attack? Many people say worry about the terrorists getting hold of a nuclear weapon or making a nuclear weapon. I point out that the North Korean nuclear explosion was about 400 tons of TNT equivalent. That sounds like a lot, but if you realize that the one airplane going into the World Trade Center carrying 60 tons of jet fuel, when that burned, it released the energy equivalent of 900 tons of TNT. 900. It's more than twice the energy of the North Korean nuclear bomb. And that was just an airplane filled with jet fuel. I believe that the dangers from terrorism come from the conventional fuels. The dangers of nukes are quite small, I believe, simply because it's very hard to make, and in the end you get one, and North Korea exploded one, and it was only 400 tons, whereas gasoline can do a great deal of destruction. So the conventional attack is something I worry about more than the nuclear attack.
Something I saw as a thread in the advice that you're giving to the president and what you're teaching him about science in your book is a lot of it is debunking some of the misrepresentations or misunderstandings about various issues.
Well, even Al Gore in Inconvenient Truth quotes Mark Twain as saying the trouble with most folks isn't their ignorance, it's knowing so many things that ain't so. You know, the irony there is that's a self-illustrating aphorism because it wasn't Mark Twain who said that. It was Josh Billings. Everybody thinks it was Mark Twain, but ain't so. So there are many things that we think are true and can affect our policy, and which turn out just not to be true. The fact that Hurricane Katrina, for example, was due to global warming, not so. That there will now be many more Hurricane Katrina-like events. Well, there are no other cities on the U.S. coast that are below sea level. That's not going to happen. That it was a Category 5 storm that hit New Orleans. It was actually Category 3. It was Category 5 when it was out at sea, but not when it hit New Orleans. Issues about radioactivity and how bad it is. The chance of getting cancer from a radioactive dose are really very small. It doesn't mean Chernobyl doesn't spread cancer, but very little of the cancer we see in the Soviet Union or in Eastern Europe came from radioactivity. People are surprised to learn that less than 1% of the people who were killed in the Hiroshima bomb died of radiation-induced cancer. So when you're worrying about cancer from radioactivity, you have to know the numbers. There's so much fear out there. It's like the fear of witches, or in the 1950s, the fear of communists. Everything that was wrong was blamed on the communists. People are afraid of radioactivity. They need to be educated. Just as the president needs to understand this, the president needs to be the country's physics teacher. There are just so many things that we think we know that aren't true. We think man is needed in space in order to make discoveries. Well, the astronauts on the moon played very little role in making any discovery whatsoever. Much better to have robots up there. send humans into space for adventure, for the thrill of it, but not for science. Science works better without a human around, making the equipment more expensive.
Do scientists like you get frustrated when they see so many of these myths or the fear of things that there are, that should be much less fearful than other things out there? And is that also something that prompted you in this direction?
I think the fact that when policy is based on misinformation, it's even worse than when it's based on wrong information. There's a lot of this happening with global warming now. There are people who are purposely, knowingly exaggerating global warming as a way to get the attention of the public. And I have problems with that. I can see why they do it. Katrina is much more dramatic than a 1 degree Fahrenheit temperature rise. But I worry that when scientists do this, we lose credibility, that we're seen as people who are willing to exaggerate to present our point of view. I think the role of a scientist has to be like the judge, dispassionate, we'll give you the facts, nothing but the facts, we'll tell you what they mean, but we will not exaggerate because it happens to agree with our politics. You know, I'm trying to get my students not to just learn the material in the class, but to commence on a lifelong learning of physics and technology. One of the things I do is I have them read newspaper articles every week having to do with high technology or physics. And this is something that I hope they will continue, that they will realize that physics is something they need to know, they need to keep up on, that when new things break, that I'm teaching them that they can understand them. Other people say, oh, this is, you know, requires advanced physics to understand this stuff. No, that's not true. Essentially, everything that's in the newspapers are things that you can really understand, not just sit back and say, wow, I wish I could understand that. No, you can understand that, and many of these things are really important.
Something I noticed in your class is that you connect it so closely with people's lives and current events that it's almost as if you can't afford not to understand it.
If any student walks out of my class, says to himself or herself, why do I need to know that? Then I have failed. A nice thing about physics is that so much of physics is clearly relevant to important national and international issues, that if I restrict myself just to the things that are obviously important, I still have more than enough material to fill up an entire semester. So that's what I do. I think one of the key things I do is to truly respect the student, really recognize these are the future leaders of the world. And the students can sense that. And I'm teaching them the things that they will need to know. And in physics, that's relatively easy to do.
Your class was voted in the student newspaper, The Daily Cal, the best class at UC Berkeley. So even though it's this 500-student class, and somebody might think it's this impersonal, dry class, it almost sounds like you're completely turning that idea over.
I try to commune with my students as best as possible. I don't know them all by name. I do exchange email, personal email, with every one of them. We set up our structure and our teaching assistants so that they get to know their teaching assistants very well. I pick and choose, and I get the best teaching assistants in the university. They are all highly motivated, too. The students know that we are very anxious for them to know this stuff, that it's important for them to know it. They sense this attitude. They sense our respect for them. The chemistry works really well.
Okay, Physics for Future Presidents, what the president needs to know about physics. Does the president also need to know something about education, higher education?
I'm sure. I see the president as being our first teacher. The president needs to be able to explain his policies to the public. He needs to convince them that it's right. And he can only do that if they understand the issues. I think if you're explaining what you're going to do with the economic crisis, You can say, here's what my advisor suggested, and that won't go over very well. But if you say, here's what we need to do, and this is why we need to do it, and explain what's going on, I find that people really respond to an education. It's one of the great joys to learn something. And if you can explain something in such a way that someone else knows that they understand it better, they are empowered, and they like that. This happens with my class. I can see the students. I tell them that I don't care whether you're pro-nuke or anti-nuke, you're going to know a lot about nukes. And when you know a lot about nukes, you're going to go home and you're going to win arguments with your parents, because knowledge is power. And they know that too. And I love to get these stories coming back about how they went home and they were discussing some subject, and one of their parents or their friend says, wow, how do you know about that? And it's true. If you know some more, you are a more powerful person.
So you're reaching these 500 students per semester in your classroom. You're reaching out to the president and the general public through your book by the same name. And your course is being webcast by the university throughout the world.
Well, that's been a wonderful experience, unexpected. The university asked me if I'd be willing to webcast, and I said, what's that? You know, and they explained it to me, and I said, oh, that might be useful. If one of my students misses a class, then the student can listen in. And a few months later, they asked me, are the students using it? And I said, I don't know. So I asked my class, I said, would you please email me if you're using the webcast? And I got an answer from Missouri. That surprised me. So the next lecture, I said, anybody not in Berkeley, please email me. And they started coming in from all around the world. I started keeping track, 87 countries so far, including one from Timbuktu and from a high school student in Malaysia who is so grateful to the University of California for enabling him to get an education on things that he couldn't possibly do in his own country. These emails are just fantastic. Almost all of them show enormous gratitude that we should share this kind of teaching. And they're finding out what a Berkeley education is. And for my part, as a teacher, it's enormously rewarding to feel that I'm reaching beyond my 1,000 students a year out into the world like this. It's very satisfying and very rewarding, and a little bit intimidating when I realize that I am up there not in front of just 500 students, but maybe, oh, I don't know how many, 87 countries. People have responded from these countries. I have no idea how many people are actually watching.
The book is Physics for Future Presidents, The Science Behind the Headlines. Dr. Mueller, thank you very much.
Pleasure to be here.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.